You're listening to NativeTalk.net. Audio files are available online at NativeTalk.net.
This is all wrong.
Listening to anything else?
I don't know what it is.
It's like kissing your brother.
It's like I'm kissing my brother.
And now, your hosts, Cliff and Brandon, we're legends in our mother's mind. Now grab your nets and let's go fishing.
Good morning and welcome to NativeTalk.net radio program. So glad you could join us this morning. Email if you want to be a part of the show is podcast@nativetalk.net. And of course, you can always make comments through the Facebook page as well. We have Brandon here, of course, and hello. And we also have a guest, Jeff, with the Sage Hawk Foundation. How you doing this morning, Jeff?
Doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I was looking a little bit about your foundation, and it was interesting to me because it explains some things about how you're trying to help folks and give them the skills that they need by teaching them things. And I'm just curious how all of that works. Like, what do you guys do?
Well, we're Sage Hawk is it's a 501c3 nonprofit. We were founded back in 2016. And our mission is to provide free computer literacy training to Native Americans who, no matter where they are, if they're struggling with poverty or unemployment, mainly stemming from lack of the proper skill sets. We have the meat of our program is a 3-month boot camp style course. It's engineered to train the student from the bottom up. You don't have to have any prior computer knowledge at all. You know, during the course, our students will learn from the very beginning about the history of computers, computer hardware, and all of its functions, and the different types of software like operating systems and applications that people use every day, even binary math. And
binary math is like ones and zeros,
right?
And zeros and ones.
you can actually add and subtract and multiply binary math, and it's a lot of fun. And we do that with our students to tell them. Mm-hmm. Teach them that this is how computers communicate with each other, and they have a lot of fun with it. It's actually more fun than base 10 math that we learned in school.
I'm gonna Google that one. I want to check out binary math because I'm a math dork. I love math, and so to hear that there's a new kind out there that I've never tried before, I want to play.
It's a lot of fun, and that's how we spike the interest of our students too, by getting them involved and letting them do some hands-on things like this. But the core of the program is a Microsoft Office suite of products, you know, like Microsoft Word, Excel, PowerPoint. And our first course took place in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, which is the county seat for the Osage Nation Reservation. So we chose the Osage as our test bed for our pilot program, and it was a tremendous success. It went perfectly. We're very proud of that. And that happened last fall.
Wow. Okay, so this is a relatively new program that you guys are running.
Yes, it is. It's something that I'm very familiar with. I'm very familiar with computers. You know, I'm a retired Army veteran, and my job in the military was cybersecurity. And I wanted to take this and give other people a chance to learn. It's very easy. There are so many people today that don't understand computers. You know, there's just so much to learn. And I wanted to help them out.
I had the benefit of growing up at a time when computers were really coming into their own. And, you know, Clifton here, he brought a bunch of computers into our bedroom when I was 9 years old. So I got the chance to learn back when a 2 gigabyte hard drive was like a big hard drive, right?
And expensive.
So it's kind of like I got a chance to become familiar with it as it was developing, and it became more digestible. But for someone who didn't have that opportunity, I can imagine looking back at all of the changes that have happened over the last 2 decades or more and have it be just this overwhelming impossible mountain to learn. And it's important. It's imperative to have these skills to work pretty much anywhere now.
Well, and that brings me to my question, because it seems to me like in today's world, it's hard for me to imagine, and this is out of pure ignorance, it's hard for me to imagine that somebody in 2019, which I can't believe we're in that year, but yep, in 2019, somebody doesn't know these things. Have you ever seen the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey? At the beginning, yes, where they're like, you know, the monkeys are jumping around. And I'm like, is it like that? You know, like the whole computer.
Wow. Wow. I don't know if it's quite like that.
Well, I mean, so that's my question for Jeff. Like, how unknowledgeable are they? Like, I mean, you guys are starting from the ground up. And so that's my point. It's just hard for me to imagine somebody knows that little. And how does that happen?
Okay, I've got some statistics for you here, and they're kind of shocking. According to a 2016 article in the Nielsen-Norman Group, and the distribution of users' computer skills across 33 modern or rich countries like the United States, England, Japan, all of these wealthy nations, only 5% of the population has computer-related abilities on a high-level scale. And only a third of people can completely operate a computer at the medium complexity task level.
Wow.
A quarter of adults in the world, 25% of adults in the world, cannot use a computer. And the remaining 75%, of that remaining 75% of those who can use a computer, only 5% of those can use it at a high level. The U.S. Bureau of Statistics found in 2012 that more than half of jobs require some kind of technology skill. By 2020, that number is forecast to reach 77%. That means in less than 3 years, 3 out of 4 jobs in this country, in the United States, will require some level of computer proficiency. Microsoft Office skills are some of the most in-demand skills there are.
And taken for granted, too. It's not like they go, can you use Microsoft Word? Jobs just assume that you need it.
Right. Most people cannot do it. Most people cannot operate a computer beyond Facebook, texting, or Twitter, believe it or not.
2, 3.
Okay. According to a 2016 article in the Nielsen-Norman Group, the distribution of users' computer skills across 33 rich nations like the United States, Japan, England, France, only 5% of the population has computer-related abilities, and only a third of the people can complete medium complexity tasks on a computer. A quarter of all adults in the world cannot even use a computer. And of the remaining 75% that can use a computer, only about 5% of those can use a computer at a high level. That is to say, can they do processing? Can they operate applications outside of Facebook or Twitter?
How do they get on Facebook and Twitter if they don't know how to use a computer?
Take our grandfather, for example. He wants to use Facebook and Twitter, but he's literally uncomfortable pushing the power button. Like, he thinks if I push the power button to turn on the computer, it's going to break it. So he has mom or dad turn on his computer so that he can get onto Facebook and social
most
media.
Most people are not doing that. So, I mean, come on. If you don't know how to use a computer, how are you doing Facebook and Twitter? I mean, really, how do you set up your own account?
Well, that speaks well to the coders, that they make it so user-friendly now that you don't have to have any skill at all just to, you know, be prompted along to set up an account.
Maybe it would be helpful to, I mean, do you explain this to people who, like, maybe if you know how to use Facebook, hey, you basically know how to use a word processor. You just open it. Start a blank document and start typing. It's really that simple.
Well, I think we both know that's not entirely true. I mean, there's paragraph formatting. There's 100 different things that you can do, from changing text to hanging indents to all of this other stuff in Microsoft Word. It's not just as simple as typing.
That's true. However, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I was going to say he's absolutely correct. There, you have a whole menu bar up there of different things. You have to be able to format text and do all these kind of acrobatics with your text to format, you know, to make it like a
college paper.
Like a college paper. People have no clue how to do that.
True, but if they can have the confidence to open it and show that they can put their thoughts on paper, it's a start. And then you can say, hey, by the way, here's this, how this works, this works, this works. I mean, like, you can build on that. But if you show them, it's as easy as opening it up and start typing. Like, you can go from there. You know what I mean?
Right. And I want to back up a little bit and say something about the fact that we work with the Native American community. I don't want it to be assumed that we're blaming Native American community. Well, that's not the right way to say it. To assume the Native American communities are the only ones who have problem with computer literacy, that's not true at all. This problem exists across all demographics.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Every community has large groups of people that cannot operate a computer or are afraid to use a computer. And they have to get over that fear factor first. But again, you know, my foundation is focused to the Native American community, so we're helping them. But I do want it known that, you know, this is a problem that exists all over the world with every group.
And that's really eye-opening for me, because when I hear about the problem, my mind automatically assumes, oh, it's because they're lower income. They don't have the money to afford a computer. And that's just incorrect assuming on my part, because, you know, like you said, it happens to every group, whether you're making a lot of money, you're young, you're old, you're poor, anything in between, everybody has problems with this, you know?
Right. And, you know, computers now, and I was discussing this with Brandon earlier, they're becoming so prolific now that almost anyone can afford a handheld phone, you know, smartphone.
Yeah, somehow.
I've seen homeless people with smartphones. you can get an Android pretty cheap. And
not a good one.
Not a good one, but hey, one you know. First. But I tell you, let me tell you a little fact about smartphones that not many people understand or even realize. There is more processing power in your hand in a smartphone, whether it be Android or iPhone, than in all of Mission Control's computers combined during the moon landings. In one handheld smartphone, you have more processing power than NASA had in 1970.
And if I remember right, those NASA computers would fill up an entire room. They were so big.
Exactly right. But think about it. You can put an app for every function of a moon landing on your phone and monitor a rocket from Earth to the moon and back.
And that was my question, because I've heard that about a lot of different devices, because, you know, processing power grew so quickly. And I'm like, great, I've got processing power. What do I do with it? I can't land a rocket on the moon.
Well, you know what people do with this amazing amount of processing power today? They go to Twitter or Facebook or send pictures of their kittens or puppies.
Well, those are very cute.
Yeah. But that's what this is the most advanced form of technology Earth has ever known. You've got all of humanity's knowledge to date at the touch of a finger.
And people don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and that's why I think foundations like yours are so imperative to building people up to be successful. Because when I was a kid, my mom taught me reading unlocks the world. If you can read, you can do anything. You can learn anything from a book if you just know how to unlock the information. And I feel that that's the same truth about computers today. If you can have basic computer literacy, not quite the medium and high side yet, but if you get to at least the basic level, then you now have the blocks to use to build up to the medium and high levels, you know. But I think if you don't start somewhere, you're really at a handicap trying to be successful in the world today.
And this is my next question to Jeff here, because I know that your foundation there is based in Oklahoma. A lot of tribes down there in Oklahoma. What if you're on, like, I don't know, the what's that one up in North Dakota?
You're talking about the Pine Ridge Reservation?
Yeah, like that one. What if I'm up there and they need computer skills? You know, do they got to come on down to Oklahoma to talk to you guys?
That's not in Dakota, but the Pine Ridge Reservation is one of the reservations that we have on our radar, because that's one of the worst, as far as poverty, in terms of poverty, that's one of the worst reservations in the United States. There's a lot of misconceptions about reservations. But to answer your question, we started at the Osage Nation in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. And what we're trying to do is establish a permanent location there. Once we establish a classroom in a certain tribal community, we want to make it permanent. And then we want to expand from that point to other nations, like the Cherokee Nation, the Apache Nation, Lakota. Wherever they are in the United States, we want to expand to those areas.
So, like, put a foundation in each of those areas? Like a location?
Sort of like a field office classroom. We want to have a permanent presence. We want to be able to reach all tribal communities. There's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about reservations to the normal person walking around every day. If you've ever been on a reservation, now, some of them are different. No two are alike. But let me give you an example with the Osage Nation Reservation, which is, their county seat is Pawhuska, Oklahoma, which is about an hour and a half north of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Well, you won't know you're on a reservation unless you see the sign on the side of the road as you're driving down. It looks like any other county in the United States. You've got towns there just like anywhere else. So unless you see a sign on the side of the road, you probably don't realize you're on a reservation. But reservations, and there is so much ignorance out there. There are still people who think Native Americans live in teepees, believe it or not. And it's ridiculous.
Do they not realize that not all Native Americans ever lived in teepees? Those were like the plains. You've got long houses and the
types. This goes back to the level of ignorance in society today. People are not learning the things they should learn. There are so many. See, Native Americans are particularly impacted because they have negative stereotypes. There's racism. They've been exposed to broken promises, corruption, marginalization, lack of infrastructure on these reservations. And all these things add up. And the end result is that the ordinary person on the ground ends up receiving the full brunt of all these societal forces arrayed against them. And so it's a catch-22 situation. And that's why people that live on a reservation have such struggles.
Those are disconnected from everywhere else?
Well, there are people living on some reservations, like the Pine Ridge Reservation that we talked about before. That one is particularly bad because there's a lot of gang activity there. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of alcoholism. There's a lot of drug use. You've got high school dropouts. I mean, it's horrible. It's a terrible thing. You've got multiple families living in one broken down mobile home with no electricity. The only heat they get is from propane, a propane tank connected to their trailer. And it's just a terrible situation. Let me walk through one of these scenarios for you.
Okay.
And this is how Native Americans end up in a bad situation. So if we walk through this scenario, we see parents ending up working themselves to death in a dead-end, low-paying job that has a high turnover rate. Sometimes their paycheck is so small that it comes down to having to choose between buying food or paying the bills.
Oh.
So survival comes first. So food gets priority, right?
That has to.
Okay. When there is not enough money left to pay the bills, or like I said before, to buy propane or butane to stay warm or cook or buy water and electricity, a lot of these places don't have water and electricity or even plumbing. Desperation and hopelessness will set in. And if you're lucky enough to even have a credit score, your credit score is going to suffer. You won't be able to get a loan without a 50% interest rate. And many turn to finding comfort, unfortunately, in a bottle, or end up becoming an alcoholic or using drugs. Now, parents might resort to they might have to resort to theft or other forms of crime just to survive, stay alive.
Which, or to make, putting myself in that situation, I can imagine myself, that's where I would go to right away. If it was between feeding my family and or not, I could see myself breaking into a store or something to get food for my family.
But right. Yeah, you're going to opt to survive. You're going to take care of your family no matter what.
Couldn't you, if you're a Native American and you're out on the reservation and you are living in a trailer without the heat, electricity, why, and I've wondered this, why not just go back to the old days when before we had those things, build a cabin or a longhouse or whatever the traditional form of housing was, go back to hunting, go back to gathering, go for fish.
Pretty hard when the whole country is owned by the United States government. You can't put a log cabin up somewhere. You can't go hunt on any
ground. On your reservation, you're living on a reservation.
But like he said, most reservations look no different than a regular suburb.
Right. And here's the problem with a reservation. And reservation, by the way, is one of the nicer terms used for these areas. The more militant segment will call them, what's the phrase I'm looking for? Concentration camps.
Ah.
And but see, here's the problem with doing that. People don't invest in infrastructure on reservations because the land, you cannot own the land. You can own a house on the land, but the land is leased, and it's leased to the Native American tribal community for X number of years. So you may own a house, but the land, you cannot own that land. One day, well, worst case scenario, the lease may expire, and then all of a sudden, What if the next owner of that lease decides your house doesn't need to be there? So that's the problem with living on a reservation. And that's why a lot of people don't want to put infrastructure there. But that's kind of ridiculous because that mindset is because I've known people that's lived on reservations for decades. I mean, that's just, it's just not something you should really be concerned about.
No, I agree. Yeah.
But being on a reservation is not quite the same as living anywhere else in the United States.
You know, I was also curious about the follow-up to that scenario you painted about the family that's struggling to stay warm, struggling to eat. You know, I was wondering what the continuation you were going with that was.
Well, like I said before, a lot of people become discouraged. And they find themselves living multiple families in one home. And one of the things that we do at Sage Hawk is we try to get people to understand that you can be successful if you're self-sufficient. Unfortunately, more people now these days have become dependent on the government for their subsidies. And when the government stops or shuts down, like it's shutting down right now, sometimes those checks stop. And the food stops. So that's why we exist at Sage Hawk, to give people a marketable skill that they can take out and have a good job with a good pay, that they don't have to be dependent. They can be independent. That is the whole purpose of Sage Hawk's mission, to help people become self-sufficient. One of the things that we're putting into the course is a scholarship program. I want to be able to bring someone in, whether or not they have a high school diploma or not, if they're a dropout, I want them to be able to earn through our course a scholarship for a GED program where they can re-enter the education process. Or
that's important.
Based on their performance in the class. And also, if let's say if we have one of our students who is a high school graduate, but they've been out of the system for a while and they're falling behind in technology, we want to be able to teach them. And if they have a, if they come up with a certain grade point average in our course, they would be eligible to win a scholarship to a two-year junior college of their choice.
Ah. Believe me, those can be expensive. Oh, comparatively, they're cheap, but they can be expensive for folks.
Well, we want to be able to help our graduates like that. We want to be able to help them get out and re-enter society into the workforce. And to, like, we want to be able to bootstrap their learning experience into a, you know, so they can go to college, go back to get their GED. We're working on that too.
And I, one of the reasons why I think that that is so important is coming from a person who has the personal drive. I've been out there. I've, you know, achieved a good level of success. But looking back, if I didn't have people who stood beside me, who helped me, who taught me, who pushed me, you know, it was my personal drive. I did it. But I could not have done as much or gone as far if I didn't have good people behind me, helping me, pushing me. And so there are a lot of folks out there who don't have that, and I find that to be a tragedy. So the fact that there is a situation or a an organization that can give that to people, I think is incredible.
Well, we try to address the causes of poverty, not the symptoms. There's a lot of great charities out there that do good things, but unfortunately, so many of them try to address the symptom of poverty, not the cause. And to me, the cause, you can repair a lot of these problems just simply by getting a good education. Now, education alone is not the answer. You also have to have ambition, and ambition comes from motivation, and we try to motivate our students to do better.
As they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force them to drink. So right. a lot of it is on their shoulders.
Exactly.
All right.
But, you know, there may be a Mozart or an Einstein who's sleeping in a ditch because they're an alcoholic because they've given up on life just for lack of money or lack of opportunity. Somebody may hold the cure for cancer, but it'll never come to light because no one's giving them a chance to succeed. We want to give everybody that's fallen a chance to succeed.
Or fail, because, you know, a lot of times a failure can be a step to success. So,
absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. That's the biggest teacher of all is failure.
Yep. But if you're afraid, you'll never even try, which means you don't have a chance to succeed or fail. I've always said, as long as I got a shot at it, I don't care if I fail, as long as I tried. Because in the failure, you learn. But if you don't do anything, then you never even have the chance to do either. So giving people the opportunity to go out there and do that, helping them, then, you know, they eventually will succeed, I believe.
People need to have confidence in themselves. You know, just because life has dealt you a bad hand. You know, I like to say also that if your ship doesn't come in, swim out to your ship.
Exactly. As long as the ship's out there, I'll reach it one way or the other.
Exactly right.
Yeah, and like I just wanted to echo that failure is a good teacher sentiment. That's what I do to my son. That's why the speech that I give to my son whenever he messes up on math or gets frustrated with something he can't do right. I tell them the best way to learn how to do something perfect is to mess up on it 1,000 times. You know, learn what not to do. Yeah. You know, picture filling up a cup with water. The best way to learn how to fill it up perfect is to overflow, you know, and get used to it.
You know, I've worked in a couple of different factory jobs in my life. And a factory job can be very repetitive. And when you start out, you're always clumsy, you know, you don't know what you're doing. But after about 2 weeks, all the inefficiencies are weeded out. And what's left is you know exactly what you're doing. There are no mistakes. You are as accurate as a machine. And But like Brandon said, practice makes perfect.
But nobody's perfect. So why practice?
So why practice?
Yeah.
I have always, in my early in my career, I enjoyed those monotonous, brain-numbing jobs because you're earning money. You've got like a good foundation to build from. And because you don't have to think too hard, you also have the opportunity to think about like, okay, what am I going to do to improve myself, my next job? You know, like I have always had time to think. Painting is monotonous. I'm sorry, yeah. But it is. That's our father is a house painter. And when we're out there working, I had a lot of time to think and plan. So, yeah, you know,
I was a teenager at that time. So I had a lot of time to think about girls.
Yeah, exactly. I did too. We were young, but those jobs are not bad jobs. They're good starting places, you know? So
that's something I want to point out. There's no such thing as a bad job. All honorable jobs. Hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with hard work and getting your money.
Amen.
But there is a way to make more money, and it just it requires you to apply yourself, increase your education level, and get out there and try. You may fail, but everybody fails now and then.
You know, my boss actually told me that when I interviewed for it, it was clear to him I didn't have the skills to do the job at a professional level. But he said he liked my he could tell that I was a person who could do things, and he was willing to teach me, you know. And if you can present that to your hiring manager to where they say, hey, this guy doesn't know how to do this, but I can teach him. If they believe you're teachable, they'll mentor you, you know. And that's you talk to successful people, at some point in their lives, there was someone who was willing to mentor them and help them and push them along professionally.
Exactly right. And that's happened to me too. But you got to have that ambition. You got to have that positive attitude because they pick up on that.
That's the willingness to learn. Yeah. Right. Saying, I'm here. What do you want me to do? I think about the Karate Kid, you know, wax on, wax off, paint the fence.
Exactly.
You know?
Hey, you know, I read a book by Steve Martin, the comedian Steve Martin, and one of the lines in his book was, I forget the name of the book, but one of the lines said, perseverance is a great substitute for talent. And I said, that is so wise. Man, that is a great piece of wisdom there. You don't have to know anything, but if you're consistent and persistent, someone's going to say, okay, I'm giving you a chance. You really want it. I'm going to give you a chance. So perseverance is a great substitute for talent. The talent can come later, but the perseverance, that'll open doors for you.
Absolutely. I have I have one question adding on to that, because I was a hiring manager. I was assistant at a couple of hotels, and I had the benefit of being able to see the applicants and choosing the people that I would hire. And over my career, I've had instances where I've had Native American people come in from various tribes and apply at the hotel. I want to just entry level, be at the front desk and stuff. But in their interview, I'm trying really hard, and they're just not getting it. They're not doing it comes off as weird sometimes. And I'm like, what's going on with this person? And then they'll like leave messages where they're like, and laughing and saying things that are just inappropriate in a professional setting. And I wish that I could A, hire them. I can't, because I have a responsibility to the hotel to do what it needs. And, you know, and so as much as I want to hire these folks, I can't. So, like, do you guys help them learn how to interact in a proper way in order to land those jobs? Because we never got to the point where, what kind of computer skills do you know? Because they were out way before that.
Okay. Well, again, this is a problem that impacts everyone, every demographic. I mean, it's not just Native Americans. It's everyone. Companies everywhere are complaining of that. One of our partners, we are partnered with job placement services, because we work with them to help our graduates get a job where they can use their newly earned computer skills. Well, they tell me that they are suffering for lack of computer trained people and people who don't know how to give an interview. So one of the programs we put in at SageHawk is a class that's placed near the end of the course that's designed to teach our students how to groom and dress for an interview and how to behave in an interview.
Awesome.
Their resume would have already been constructed in a previous Microsoft Word class. Okay.
Don't wear pajamas to job interviews.
Pajamas, no. But one of the things we will do is set up mock interviews with the real local business leaders toward the end of the course. And although the students are not actively applying for a real job at this point in the course, because they haven't graduated yet, it's still a valuable scenario for two reasons. Number one, the student receives interview training and experience. Okay, we teach them how to dress and behave. And number two, the business leader conducting the mock interview learns the student's name and face and may actually keep that person in mind for an upcoming job in their company.
I like it.
I do too.
It's sort of a sneaky way of getting this person's name into the system. And after graduation, like I said before, we work with one of our job placement service partners to assist a graduate with getting a job, and not just a job where they go out and dig a ditch or something, or some kind of hard labor job where they get minimum wage, but a job where they can use their computer skills. In fact, our pilot program has already done that. One of our students in our pilot course was able to go out and get a computer-related job before graduation because of the things that we taught.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we've already had a big success right at the very beginning.
I know what it feels like intimately to fail badly.
Yeah, I'll say.
A couple of months ago, I started a new job. It's a sales job. Business-to-business sales. So I'm going into local businesses. I sell copy machines, for goodness sakes, you know. So my primary goal at first is to get – I just want a decision maker's name. And I went into this dentist office. It was like my first week out in the field. I had somebody going with me, and I did everything wrong. I like leaned in over the counter. I was like, so I see you have a copy machine over there. And I'm like, who's the decision maker's name? She goes, the dentist. And I'm like, oh, does he have a card? No. And I'm like, who do you have taking care of your copy machine? I'm not telling you. I mean, like, I ruined it so bad. And I should have left, but I ruined it. And what I've learned is frequency is important. Because the more you do something, the more you're going to get better at it. And so through that failure, my partner was able to say, hey, here's what you did wrong. Everything. So don't do any of that ever again. And we practiced. And with frequency, doing it over and over and over again. Because I do have job skills. But it put me in a new situation that I have not done before, and I'm going to be bad at it. So you got to do it again and again and again, and then it like comes together. You know what I mean? And so if you are doing mock interviews with business owners, teaching them how to dress, and you know you're doing it again, it gives them that history, you know, where that frequency, so that when it comes down to the real thing, they can do a good job.
So, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong. You said your course was it a three-month program?
It's a three-month program. Right.
Three-month program, yeah. And for most of I've been through a few educational institutions, and most of the time, they don't even bother with one time. You know, Clifton's talking about repetition and whatnot. They don't even care about that the first time. So I just want to commend you and say to incorporate that into your program and give them a shot to have a real interview. Well, I know it's not a quote-unquote real interview. They're not going for the actual job, but other than that, that's the only piece that seems to be missing to me. Other than that, it's a real interview. And I just want to say that that is invaluable as someone who's gone through education and got thrown to the wolves. And it was up to me to go out there and, like Cliff said, fail until I got enough skills to be able to seem impressive to somebody enough to hire me. But yeah, just being able to fit that into a 3-month program, it's really impressive.
Well, it's not that difficult, actually. It's and one of the great things about using real business leaders from the local community is they develop a sense of sympathy or empathy toward the student, because they say this person's really trying, you know, and they're gonna come back with some good feedback. But they're gonna say, well, maybe you shouldn't have said this to me during the interview, or maybe you should sit a different way. You know, you'd have more success if you spoke at a certain tone. They can get positive feedback, and only good can come from it.
I completely agree. Now, I've got a question, because in any job that you start, if you get decent at it, usually you get a better job. And I've often thought about, you know, poor folks, people who are having a difficult time because of where they live. And what do I always say? Move, go somewhere else. But if you get a decent job, you get skills and you move away, that leaves that community in a worse situation. I mean, it's great for that guy, but, you know, that's not good for the community. And now you've got somebody who could be teaching his fellow, community members. He's not there anymore. He's down in Tulsa or something like that, you know? So, I don't know. Right. What do you do about situations like that?
Well, I've had this brought up to me before by community leaders in tribal areas, and that's definitely a real issue that needs to be addressed. I believe it's connected. Personally, I believe it's connected with the infrastructure on a reservation. Most reservation county seats are fairly well imbued with small businesses and tribal government offices. And like I said earlier, when you're in a small town in a reservation, you probably won't even realize you're on a reservation. It's just like any other small town anywhere in the country. Okay, they look identical. There's no difference there, except there's a tribal government office there. But there's always room for growth. There needs to be more business incubators that can attract investors to create jobs that expand utilities deep into the reservations. And our students can directly contribute to this. And like Brandon said before, he was speaking about this. He said, can any of your students come back and help you as sort of a repayment to what they've learned? Well, I would rather them go into their local communities and try to set up a small business or find a business incubator where you can, at a very, very low fee, you can open up your own business and try to provide a service there that doesn't exist. And
teach your fellow tribal members, you know, in a real world setting, how to improve themselves in a, you know, because
exactly
I wish I owned a hotel where I could hire all these people and teach them, you know?
Right. So there are so many things computer knowledge can do to help an area grow. And I think good things can happen for people that go back and invest into their infrastructure.
Absolutely. And I think what you guys are doing is wonderful. I think the folks who are impacted negatively by these situations, they deserve help, you know? Go ahead, Brandon.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just curious. Is there any way for our listeners, if they hear this program and they, like us, agree with it and think it's a good thing that'll make real, lasting, positive impact? Is there anywhere that we can go to donate or to help?
Funny,
maybe we're not.
That's exactly where I was going.
Oh, my bad. Sorry to step on your
toes.
No,
go ahead. Go ahead, man. You asked it. So, yeah, how do folks help?
Well, as far as our personal mission at Sagehawk, if you just go to our website at sagehawk.org, you can. There's a donate tab there, and there's also a contact. You can send a message to us. And we have a Facebook page, too, at Sagehawk Foundation on Facebook. And we don't have a Twitter account yet, Bob. We're still relatively new, and we're working on our social media exposure. So that's coming. But in the meantime, you can everything you need, you can find through our website.
Excellent. All right. So anybody who wants to find out more and help out folks who are disadvantaged and desirous of improving themselves, I think that's a great thing. So go to www.sagehawk.org. And check out the, you know, all about them. And they do. I looked at that. There is a donate. So I encourage folks to do that. All right. That will do it for us today. Thank you, as always, for listening. We'll be back next week with more stimulating Native Talk Radio, available online at nativetalk.net. The phone number here, if you want to drop us a line, leave a message, 970-278-5791, or visit us online at facebook.com/Native Talk Radio for our Facebook page. Have a great day. We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, all.
Are we heeding all the signs? Have we lost our intuition? Are we running out of time?
You're listening to the NativeTalk.net radio podcast, now cooked in 100% vegetable oil. Be sure to look for the new fat-free items on the menu. Now grab your nets and let's go fishing.